Blog Talk Radio.
What if you were wearing something sexy? What if you were drinking? What if you made the first move? No matter what, sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, reminding you, it's never your fault.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys or check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And I'm also on Instagram. Check me there, Saturdays with Joy Keys. And if you want to send me an email, please do. I love to hear from you, any comments or suggestions, concerns. You can email me saturdayswithjoykeys@hotmail.com. Wow. Well, today I'm just back in love with Paul Robeson right now. Like, there is no man that can compare. I will not be in love with anybody else for quite a while. And you know why? It's the fault of Dr. Redmond. She wrote this wonderful book, Everything Man, and it's just like, wow, amazing. I believe this is her on the line here. I'm going to check here. Good morning, Dr. Redmond.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing quite well. How are you?
I'm in love with Paul Robeson.
I'm so glad to hear that. I am too.
I mean, wow, like, what am I supposed to do now after reading this? I mean, you compare him to the mountains and the water and his voice and the hologram. I'm just like, ah!
Yeah, that's kind of the effect that I think he has on people. Once you know him, it's hard to know anyone else.
Very amazing, and a lot of deep research you did. I appreciate that. It is not light reading, but it's beautiful, beautiful writing, almost meditative in a sense, I felt in reading it, because of the different connections you made about him, his body of work, you know, where you go from play, you know, she has different chapters in the book. So we'll talk about that. But this isn't her first book, and she's also a teacher, and she's a musicologist. Is that how I say it? A musicologist?
Yes.
So what made you decide to write this book about Paul Robeson? Tell the audience.
Well, I had been introduced to him as a college student. I actually was fortunate enough to take a seminar with his granddaughter, Susan Robeson, when I was in college. And then he, you know, kind of stuck with me a little bit. I wasn't, you know, I was only 20 at the time, so, you know, not paying as much attention as I should have. But in graduate school, I wrote my dissertation about music, protest musics in the African world, and that became my first book, Anthem, and he was a figure in that project. And in doing research for it, I kind of reintroduced myself to him and became thoroughly and completely invested in this person, although I never intended to return to him as a subject. I thought I had written about him in that book and that would be fine, but he's one of these people, and I've heard this from other people I've had conversations with, that once he grips you, he never leaves you. He's always in your mind somewhere. And it was the case that I was doing research for another project, and I kept encountering him either in poetry or other scholars talking about him or seeing his presence in a number of different exhibits that I had witnessed. And so once I recognized that there was a pattern emerging, I figured, well, instead of fighting this, let me just go with it and see if there's something there. And sure enough, there was plenty to say.
Now, you're at UCLA, correct? You're still there?
Yes.
Professor at UCLA?
Yes.
And you're doing global jazz studies? Is that you're still focusing there?
Global jazz studies and musicology, yes.
Musicology. Now, do you play any instruments yourself?
I was a singer in my previous life. I'm not very practiced anymore, but formerly a singer, yeah.
So that's the connection there. And now, what is this name, Everything Man? Tell the audience Why did you name the book Everything Man? Oops, sorry, there was some music came in.
That's okay. I actually got that language from Talib Kweli, who sampled a song from a group called Daybreak in the 70s called Everything Man. And that language is a reference to all of the different forms that you mentioned earlier that I kind of track his presence through. So the fact that he was revealing himself as poetry and literature, as sound, as the built environment. So, you know, the numerous homes that are named after him, student centers at various college campuses, the mountain peak that's named after him in Kyrgyzstan. You know, he was just taking shape in all of these different ways. And it, you know, is a bit tongue in cheek to call him Everything Man. But early in the project, I have quotes from various people, including his life partner, Islanda Good Robeson, who said, you know, that everybody wanted him to be everywhere. He was everything to everyone. And, you know, so that language to me, while a little cheeky, actually, I think, does some justice for trying to think about how big a presence he was during his lifetime and since.
Yeah, I really like you broke it down. So let's start at the beginning. You talk about his voice and the breadth of his voice and how it was able to move around the globe even when he wasn't. That was really actually sad for me. You know, it was sad that he could not move around after a certain point. I really was, like, angry in reading, you know, that section. Tell the audience a little bit about why he could not move around, and but yet he still was able to move around with his voice. Talk about that a little bit.
Right. So his voice is really the whole foundation of the project. And I think, you know, there have been folks who have written about him as kind of an icon of the labor left or an icon of Cold War persecution. But I really wanted to get back to the thing that he identified as the most essential element of himself, which was his voice. And so that becomes kind of the way that I'm able to talk about him appearing in all of these different forms. But it was a really crucial element of how people were able to still communicate with him and he communicate with them was through these recordings that he would send around the world. So he was, by 1949, an enemy of the state, that the U.S. State Department actually targeted him as a radical, as a rebel, and he was out in the world talking about independence for colonized African nations. He was talking about the oppressions faced by Black Americans. He was talking about the dispossession of labor in the United States, so very much a champion for the rights of working people. And the State Department took issue with that. In 1950, they revoked his passport, refusing him travel anywhere outside of the contiguous United States. And so from 1950 to 1958, he could not travel. And it basically crushed his career. He had made a huge name for himself abroad. And so this, at that moment, under McCarthyism, the second Red Scare, he was not only unable to travel to his international audiences, but because of the fear-mongering that was happening in the U.S. federal government, was really losing all of his opportunities to perform in the U.S. as well, because they accused him of being a communist. And at that time, and perhaps in this time, that is an enemy position. So it really, he lost 95% of his income within a decade. And they sought to actually silence him, but he was able to develop these do-it-yourself recordings with his son in New York City, and send them to fans all over the world who continued to champion his voice and fight for the reinstatement of his passport, which was successful ultimately in 1958.
Now, he had this amazing relationship with the people in Wales, and I did not know about that. I am not as studied on Paul Robeson as I guess I thought I was, so I'm glad that, again, you wrote this book. It really enlightens people about the aspects of himself. And one of the things, when he was not able to move, he made a call and sang at their yearly festival. Tell the audience about their yearly festival and that moment when he was able to move with his voice, even though he couldn't move physically.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. The whole long relationship he's had with Wells is super interesting and just so compelling. In traveling there to do research for this project, it's still very evident to me that they revere him. It was a rarity that I would meet anyone, even in that moment, which was only about 2 years ago, 3 years ago now that I was there. Most people still knew his name, and that is just not the case in the U.S. And so he's been really well preserved there because he was such a heroic figure, and in large part due to his support for the miners, who were really the backbone of Welsh culture until the industry collapsed in the 1980s. So the miners are kind of the most revered workers in the national history of Wales. And he was a big champion for organized labor. And so he would often sing for the unions. He would speak to their issues from his platforms around the world. And during the period of his passport revocation, they were still wanting him to participate. So the Welsh people have a very kind of rich national choral culture, both amongst the unions, where the unions will have their own choirs, but then also national kind of competitive choirs. And so they have these singing festivals called the Steadfast, which happen annually. And they used the unions would have their own, and then there'd be the national. Now there's only the national because the unions are mostly obsolete. But during the union Eisteddfod, as well as the national Eisteddfod, he was being called to perform. And because his passport was revoked, he couldn't physically be there, but they took advantage of what was then newer technology, meaning the landline telephone. So being able to make transatlantic phone calls was a new innovation in the early 1950s. And they figured out how to develop a cable from New York City, where Robeson was stationed, into the miners of Steadfod in Porthcawl, Wales. And there were 5,000 people in the auditorium waiting to hear his voice in Wales, another couple of thousand outside hoping to get in. And he sung to them for about an hour. He sung to them, the miners sung to him, and there's this brilliant recording of it that demonstrates this this intimacy that they shared with each other, as well as having dialogue with one another. And so it's this really fantastic moment of thinking about how he was resisting all of the restrictions imposed upon him in an urgent bid to continue being with the people who mattered to him, and them really fighting for him to be there.
Yeah, I understand based on your book that he was one of the first non-Welsh speaking people to be allowed into this. Is that correct?
Yeah, so at the National Eisteddfod in the late 1950s, when he was able to return to travel, Wales was one of the first places he went, and he was an invited guest at the National Eisteddfod, and he was the first non-Welsh person to speak on the first day of the festival. So the first day of the festival traditionally was only spoken and performed in Welsh, and he got on stage and sung spirituals and sung along with the Welsh in their language. But that was the first time that English had ever been spoken and performed on the main stage at the National Eisteddfod on its first day.
Now, he not only sang in English and Welsh, but he sang in Chinese and Russian. He, based on your book, he never sang the anthem, the American anthem, but he did sing the Chinese anthem and the Russian, and I did listen to it because just getting in the mode as I was reading, I was also listening to Robeson on Spotify.
And that's the way
to get
me
there.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was really when he started singing the Chinese, I didn't think he wasn't Chinese. You know what I'm saying? The
right.
Power of it, the conviction behind the way he was singing. It was like, no, I know this. I got this. Don't worry about it. It wasn't there was no faltering. You know what I'm saying? He was there. And also with the Russian song, even though now we are about hating Russia because they mess with our elections.
Right.
Still in his song, though, was like, wow, so powerful. And it was also, again, another song of the downtrodden. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's where he connected, and I think that's why people appreciated him because he was
Absolutely.
He wasn't above anybody. You know what I mean? He was like, look, I'm here
That's
and
right.
we're all fighting this together. And the way he really tried to make it global, you know?
Yes. And that's another element of the language of Everything Man, is that
mm-hmm.
he really considered himself an everyman, that he was not better, as you said, than anyone else. He wasn't smarter. He didn't know more about the world. He just had a different platform. And so he wanted to announce other people's ways of living, other people's ways of knowing, and talk about how valuable those things were. But it's part of the way he was able to do that so successfully is that he spoke in their languages. He was a fantastic linguist. He studied language intensely, not only for his vocal catalog and repertoire, but just for the sake of being able to communicate with people as he traveled the world. And so he was conversational in dozens of languages.
Really amazing. I can tell you that language is really a door opener. Myself, I went to Poland for about 5 weeks. I was there doing theater in another life, in another place. And I've traveled to many other countries, and I've tried to learn their language. And let me tell you, people appreciate it. They will open the door. They will help you find something. They will do stuff that you would think a stranger wouldn't do because you're trying to communicate with them in their language.
Yes.
They respect you more. And I've taught my daughter that, and she laughs, you know, especially sometimes we'll get into a cab or something, and she's like, oh, God, here goes my mom. She's going to start saying something. You know, but then you have a great conversation. Now, the second
That's
chapter
right.
is talking about him. You're right. The second chapter is talking about him at play. And
mm-hmm.
people may not know he played baseball, football, shot put, and
mm-hmm.
what was the other one? I'm missing one.
Basketball.
Baseball, football, basketball. He played
mm-hmm.
four different sports. It seems like, did he not have an ego? Was he not some sense of arrogance at all? Did you find any of that in the research?
I did not. He absolutely had a sense of presence about himself, especially in his later years. He knew when he was right. So there was
mm-hmm.
that sense of confidence about him. But as far as him being, you know, a four-letter, four-season athlete, valedictorian of his Rutgers graduating class, Columbia Law School graduate, none of that produced any sense of ego in him because he very much revered and followed his father, who instilled in him the fact that this is just what we do. This is who we are. Black folks have to know better and do better than everyone else in the world just to be counted half as equal. And so he really took that to heart. And so he pursued all of his interests, all of his passions. He made sure he had his degrees, but there was never any sense of superiority about him. He always understood himself as part of a community of people, none of whom were less than he was. And it really is a big tribute to his father, who had actually escaped from slavery himself. And so that was a huge lesson for him. His father was a slave, you know, so to think about that is
and
tremendous.
And then he became a pastor.
Kind of smart. Yes, exactly. And instilled in him the fact that you just strive for excellence in whatever you do. That's it. You're not better. You're just doing the work that needs to be done.
One of the great things is because my background on theater, I really like the play chapter and this idea of playing. And sometimes people not even realize that you're playing, that you
mm-hmm.
have this language. I remember I had a relationship with this guy, and one of the things I liked about him is that he could just slip into this play mode. You know, like we'd be anywhere going down the street and he could become a character and we'd be in a restaurant doing these different things. And, you know, as an adult, you know, like you say in the book, we don't play. But play is
right.
good for adults, too. They even have coloring books now for adults.
That's
you know,
right.
Like it's crazy. You know, we're going like backwards, but to help us stay strong. You bring up in this play section how there were several plays that were written about him, but they didn't celebrate his voice. Talk about those a little
right.
bit.
Yeah, it was a really interesting thing for me to notice kind of across the one-man shows that have been developed with him as Muse, that there's very little attention paid to his voice or of him being a singer. So not only is there an issue then when casting comes along, on those rare occasions when these solo characters do sing, they often don't cast singers because the singing is just not a prominent part of the story, but it is a way of, in a way, really undermines his power as an historical figure due to the fact that they don't pay any attention to his music. This is really how the world was introduced to him, was through his voice, and this is what he considered his most powerful talent. He loved being on the stage. He loved being in films, but singing is what he did his whole life. And so for that to be absent in so many of the one-man shows that have developed is a huge loss for audiences, because they really don't end up knowing who he is unless they know his voice.
Yeah, you talk about how he is almost like a chemist on the stage, a scientist with his voice, and knowing really how to manipulate it to, I guess, get the most impact out of it. And I think that's really shown when he worked with his son and was able to, okay, you won't let me move, you won't let me go someplace, I'm still going someplace, and using technology, you know, to move, you know what I mean?
Right, because people still wanted to hear him. They were eager for him.
Yeah, I mean, I'm eager now. That's why I was, like, listening while I was reading the book. Now, the crazy thing story, one of the crazy stories is this statue that got, that disappeared. Talk to the audience about the statue of that disappeared of him and why you think it disappeared.
Yeah, so during the 1920s, Robeson, as he was gaining notoriety for himself in Harlem, became kind of a muse for a number of artists, playwrights, photographers, but also for sculptors. And there was a sculpture made of him by Antonio Salem, an Italian-American artist, which was his full body nude. And this piece, which thankfully we have a photograph of, ultimately in cast form disappeared, that both of the original casts made of the sculpture, which had been sent to various locations in order to make new sculptures for exhibition, disappeared. And so it's a really curious story about how and why this happened. There's very little information about where they might have gone or who might have received them, who might have been inclined to destroy them upon receipt of them. So it's an interesting opportunity to open up the question of both how he was curated and how he moved around the world in all of these different forms, but also to think about the fact that even as early as the 1920s, he was already under surveillance by the FBI. So it's very possible that they had some hand in the disappearance of these sculptures.
I think so. I mean, I'm a conspiracy person. I was like, they took it. They paid somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
They trashed that. They did not want to see that. I mean, the statue represented certain things for African-American community, but for them, I can imagine, first of all, he was nude. Okay, that's it.
Right.
The whole sexuality, you're taking our white women or raping them and all that whole back talk or inside talk. But then he was giving praise. It looked like, in terms of, I saw the picture, he's looking upward and holding his hands. Like you said, he wasn't arrogant, you know, like
right.
The pose would be different. Like if he had his hands on the side of his hips and stuff, like I'm here, I'm challenging you or something like that. So it was crazy that that happened, but I believe that they took it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the interesting thing about it. I believe that fully myself, but the pose of the statue, as you're saying, is really important, you know, that it's nude, and all of these debates around interraciality, around integration, around sexuality, as you're saying, but also the fact that he was, his body was in extension. He was reaching towards the sky. So he wasn't being arrogant, but he also wasn't cowering. And that's what, you know, the powers that be wanted to see. They wanted to see Black people meek and mild and beleaguered. He was not that person. And he was becoming the type of person already in the 1920s who could think really critically and in political ways, but also inspire people to do the same. And they had to stop him at all costs.
Yeah, I mean, he, like the language, that totally crossed barriers, as well as his voice. But then people, one of the things you talk about is like his present life, and his past life, his future life. It's like all these different places, and he's there all at once. Almost, I need a sci-fi movie. Like, I need Paul Robeson to be, like, in a sci-fi movie.
Amazing. Let's make it happen.
Doctor Who. Yes. Type of thing or something. I mean, seriously. And I don't know. That's just a child in me because I was a Doctor Who fan. Now, we go
that's
into
a great
the environment.
Idea.
Well, look, I put it out. I set it out into the universe. Everybody's listening. You heard
that's
it first.
Right.
Real quick, right. We only have a couple minutes left, but you talk about the environment in him. One of the things you compare him to, like the redwoods, trees. Talk a little bit about this, these analogies with Paul and the environment.
Yeah, so Mary McLeod Bethune, who was an educator and advocate and great kind of activist for Black folks, kind of set him up in her kind of descriptions of him as the tallest tree in our forest. That's how she described him. And this is kind of the metaphor that has stuck with his name throughout his lifetime. And I found that it was not just a saying. He actually has become those things. So there's a tree. There are numbers of trees that are dedicated to him on Rutgers campus. There are seeds, Russian tomato heirloom seeds that are named after him. So he has become part of the land, part of the natural environment. But then in its most spectacular form, he also has a mountain peak named for him in Kyrgyzstan, which he and Angela Davis are the two who have mountain peaks in this range named for them in this country. And so it was really curious to me to see him being so so highly thought of,
honored,
so revered,
yeah,
that people are naming their natural environment after him. And also to think about that as evidence of his permanence, that he's not going anywhere, and we should pay attention because he still has things to tell us.
And one of the things, the star, people, actors and performers get the star on Hollywood, and they wouldn't let him get a star. That was another point I was really angry. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, this is a performer's performer. He sings and he acts. I don't know if he dances, but also, you know, the funny thing is going back to the sculpture, there were pictures of him when he was nude, but they were very tasteful. And it also came to me, he was not ashamed.
No.
Like, he was not ashamed of himself, because in order to get nude, you got to be not ashamed of, you know, who you are in your body. And they were very tasteful, and he was not ashamed. And I think that was also something that made the people, the powers that be, angry. But talk to the audience a little bit about the star, why he couldn't get the star.
Well, I mean, the star was really just residual resentment against this person who had been labeled a communist and ultimately lived the last 10 years of his life pretty quietly in Philadelphia. And so there was both this mixture of a quick amnesia, but also a purposeful amnesia, that the U.S. was very deliberate in wanting to erase this person from historical memory. And so when the Actors Guild and others were activating and organizing for him to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, there was resistance from the Board of Reviewers, and they couldn't give any language to it. The only language they could say is, well, he must not have met the criteria, when in fact Mickey Mouse is getting a star at that time. The Bee Gees are getting a star at that time.
Oh,
and he's someone who's worked in all of the industries and has been a star in all of them. And they refused until people started to organize, including the workers who lay the stars, who physically install the stars in the sidewalk. They started to raise questions about why Robeson was not being included. And at that point, they reevaluated and decided, upon receipt of further evidence, that he now was honorable enough, worthy enough, to receive his star on the Walk of Fame. And it's one of my favorite moments. We recently celebrated Stevie Wonder's birthday, of course, and he was present at the laying of that star and was one of the people celebrating this milestone achievement.
I have to tell you, almost every day going to work, my other job I have, I passed the Paul Robeson mural in Philadelphia at 45th and Chestnut Street. And there are many a moments that I just stare, and like before I read your book, this is just before, just staring like, who are you? Like, where did you come from? You know what I mean? Almost like, did an alien come down? Like, is there nobody else like you? Will there be no one else? You know what I'm saying? I think Ossie Davis for me was, I thought very close to him, but just not even the breadth is just the global. That's the global thing. You know what I mean? The global impact is really one of the keys. Well, I want to thank you so much for writing this wonderful educational book. Takes us, like I said, around the globe, but also through different universes, if you will. Thank you very much for coming on the show this morning, and I just really appreciate it. I'm going to be giving away copies of your book. So the audience,
excellent.
I hope
Thank you.
Yes, no problem. It's a great book. I'm not going to have you on if I didn't think the book was good. but thank you so much, and I wish you continued success at school and also with your literature. Your next book, maybe you can come back on.
I would love that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Again, you can follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Also, Saturday mornings with Joy Keys on Facebook. And check me out on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Again, I'll be giving away copies of Everything Man, The Form and Function of Paul Robeson. So please check out the social media, follow so you can find out how to win. Everybody, you have a wonderful weekend, and please be safe. I know we're dealing with this coronavirus. Ugh, can't wait till we get past a big hump somewhere. But please take care of washing your hands and covering your face and things of that nature. And don't think just because you know somebody that maybe they don't have it, you could have it and not know it because you could be no symptoms or something. So just take care, and I'll see you guys next Saturday. Thank you very much.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of novel or new coronavirus. Take the following everyday steps to help avoid the spread of all respiratory viruses. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects or surfaces, such as remote controls and doorknobs. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. And stay home if you are sick. Call your healthcare provider if you develop fever, cough, or difficulty breathing. For more tips, visit cdc.gov.